What's going on, everybody? Welcome back to the show. We're going to do a Q&A episode. So thank you to everybody who asked a question. I appreciate it. We're going to be doing every other week a Q&A, and then the other week is going to be either a guest episode or a solo podcast. Gives me a little bit more time to prepare for those episodes. I got some really, really good feedback on that, the weight loss drug, the GLP-1 medication episode. And I've just found that I enjoy putting a little bit more work into those. And I think that the solo episodes can be really great if I don't put as much pressure on myself to do them every single week. And so every other week, I'll do a podcast with a guest or a solo episode. And then every other week will be a Q&A episode. So thank you to everybody who asked a question. I always have a lot of fun with these as well. First question up is, I heard that there are some negative side effects of caffeine and creatine. Could you speak to that? Would love your opinion. Yeah, this started a long time ago, this idea that if you have caffeine and creatine at the same time, so, you know, people putting like creatine in their coffee or let's say pre-workout with creatine in it, that the combination of them would kind of decrease the benefit of the creatine. And the truth is we just don't have amazing research on this. We have some studies that point to that being slightly less good. I will tell you, because creatine has a cumulative effect, not really an acute effect, meaning like it's about having full muscle creatine stores over time, not necessarily about, hey, I take creatine and then I go work out and acutely I get this effect. I'm not so worried about it. I suspect if you're taking enough creatine consistently on a daily basis, that even if it was slightly less, let's say you were getting slightly less muscle creatine store, saturation, even by a tiny small percent, you're probably still maxing out in terms of, like, if you're taking 5 grams and you're a relatively small person, that's probably even more than enough. So even if it was slightly less beneficial, I would file this away into not a concern of mine, especially if we're having like moderate amounts of caffeine. You know, if you're having like a cup of coffee with like 150 milligrams of caffeine, I don't suspect that to be an issue at all. Really, it wouldn't be something I'm worried about. If you're taking creatine every day and you're super duper consistent by putting it in your coffee or something, no problem. But if even a slight potential decrement or reduction in benefit kind of would just shift that habit where you're like, hey, I could just as easily not do that and have my creatine first thing in the morning with water, or, you know, at lunchtime or later in the day when I'm not having caffeine, I think that's also a reasonable approach. Even if you're like, well, if there's even a remote chance that this has an impact, maybe I'll just as easily not do it. I think that that's a fair position to take as well. Next, what are the best shoulder building exercises? Really wanting one day a week to really focus on them. I'd start by saying a couple of things. The shoulder is at least three muscles, front delt, side delt, rear delt, of which have different divisions depending on how nerdy you want to get. I also, if I was trying to grow a muscle, I wouldn't think about devoting an entire day. I would think about hitting that muscle more frequently. And so if you're like, I really want to grow my shoulders, I'd make sure I'm hitting each of those divisions, let's say, twice per week with maybe just a couple hard working sets of each. So for the front delt, I think you can do a lot of pressing movements. So you get a lot of front delt activation from things like dumbbell presses and push-ups and overhead presses. For your side delts, everything that ends in the word lateral raise, so dumbbell lateral raise, chest-supported dumbbell lateral raise, incline bench lateral raise, cable lateral raise, behind-the-back lateral raise. So a lot of lateral raises and a lot of Y raises. So anything that ends in the word lateral raise or Y raise for the side delts. And then for the rear delts, these get hit pretty darn well with a lot of pulling exercises on a variety of angles, as long as your arms are kind of what's called abducted or up off the side. If your elbows are really, really, really mega tucked, they'll get hit a little bit less. So if you have a wide array of pressing and pulling in your program, you're going to get a lot of front and rear delt. If you want to add maybe one specific exercise for each, like a rear delt fly, cable rear delt fly, and a cable front delt fly, you can do those both with dumbbells as well, maybe slightly less optimally, but you can absolutely do them as well. So I wouldn't think about devoting an entire day. I mean, you absolutely could do that, but I would think a bit more about trying to hit each of those divisions, the front, the side, and the rear, twice per week with a couple hard working sets. Next question. When you start to be in a deficit, I know there's a period it can be uncomfortable, hunger, headaches, etc. Does/should your body adjust to those deficit and those dissipate? Or if those things last multiple times, you're in too much of a deficit. So it's a complicated question, but I will say That there is a term that's going to be, I think, a bit more utilized in the near future, some appetite lag, something like that, where our hunger tends to regulate to our activity. So let's say you are a really, really active person and you all of a sudden you get injured and you have to take a week off. It'll take some time before your body regulates your appetite at all to your new activity level. So there's a bit of a lag where maybe for X amount of days, could be 3-7 days, could be a week, 2 weeks. It definitely differs. We're not really sure how long this happens. But there's a bit of a lag time where you're probably still going to be as hungry as you were when you were super active, even though you're injured now. So what I mean by that is there's certainly an adjustment period where you're, at least from a hunger perspective, the headaches, et cetera, I will talk about that. But from a hunger perspective, your body does regulate. That doesn't mean hunger goes away. But it does mean that if you're, you know, if you're finding the first couple of days of your deficit particularly challenging, that that's not abnormal. But I've seen it go both ways, where people are not very hungry in the beginning and become progressively more hungry. Other people who are really hungry in the beginning become progressively less hungry, and things level out a little bit to a reasonable degree. I've seen it go both ways. I would say on average, the first few days are the hardest, and there is some sort of hunger regulation to your new calorie intake, potentially new activity levels. So on some level, yes, I would expect them not to dissipate down to zero, but to get to a point where it's more manageable, presuming you're in an intelligent deficit, sleeping enough, managing stress, getting enough micros, drinking enough water, all that stuff. As far as headaches, I think that to me, I don't mean to assume I know exactly why you're having a headache, but to me, that is in some way normal. I'm not saying that you don't do anything about it, or I'm not glorifying having headaches, but on some level, that's normal. That can, to some degree, come from or be, let's say, ameliorated or alleviated to some degree with drinking enough water and taking enough electrolytes. You might have reduced calories. A lot of those calories maybe came from carbohydrates, whether you meant to do that or not, which is reducing, I think, sodium reuptake, let's say. And so when you go into a deficit, presumably people eat less calories, less carbohydrates. They're both in need of more electrolytes, also taking in probably less electrolytes through food. I would probably, if you're feeling this way, I would try in this context some electrolytes in your water for this period, at least while there's some sort of regulatory mechanisms going on behind the scenes as you get, you know, in air quotes, used to this deficit. But if this is happening, if you're like, I mean, let's be real. Like if you're like in a position where 10 days into your deficit, you've had nonstop headaches, the hunger has not gotten any better at all, you're ravenous, I would revisit the plan. Whether that's more calories or less calories, I think that that's, again, something that will be talked about more in the near future, this idea that actually very low-calorie dieting seems to outperform moderate calorie deficits in terms of hunger. You might find that going even lower in calories reduces hunger. I know that that's counterintuitive, you know, sounds downright blasphemous, but the research would support it. Again, that doesn't mean everybody should do that, but I think that on an individual level, you have a lot of options. But if you're like 10 days in having headaches every day, you know, hungry like crazy, I would revisit the plan. Next, had to switch gyms to Planet Fitness. How do I do RDLs? Their dumbbells go to only 75 and no barbells. I will start by saying I'm in the middle of doing a reel about Planet Fitness. A lot of Planet Fitness are upgrading their equipment. Like, mega excited about this. I have a bunch of people in my group sending form videos from Planet Fitness. They have platforms, they have barbells, they have hack squats, they have glute bridge machines. I mean, Planet Fitness is stepping up their game. It sounds like yours has not yet. I suspect that that will be coming to your Planet Fitness soon, and so I look forward to that. You know, I would say I prefer dumbbells over the Smith machine in this context. However, you're correct that original Planet Fitness dumbbells tend to only go to 75s. If you can do north of 15 perfect reps with the 75s, first of all, you're super duper, duper, duper strong. But then I would go to the Smith machine, and the Smith machine provides some benefit actually of stability. But yeah, I think it also adds in a layer of complexity where people can lean too much away from the bar. And I understand that doing the Smith machine actually sometimes is more complicated, while on paper, the extra stability might be beneficial. So if you're doing north of 15 reps with the 75s, I would go to the Smith machine and deal with what the downsides are, just so you don't have to do north of 15 reps. But I would ask the people, the managers, whoever, people who work at your Planet Fitness, whatever, if they're expecting any upgrades in the near future. I have no idea if this is being laid out to all Planet Fitnesses or just like specific ones in big cities or what have you. Next, what is more important for maintaining muscle while on a cut, protein intake or weightlifting? First of all, it's hard to say which, because if you had 0 grams of protein, that would be most important. If you didn't lift at all, that would be most important. But in almost every single practical sense of this question, the answer is weightlifting times a million. I'd rather take a person, right? I'd rather take a person lifting weights 3 times a week with a little less than optimal protein than somebody lifting once per week who's, you know, eating triple the amount of you know, what would be optimal for protein, let's say. So in general, if I have a client that is lifting 3 or 4 days a week with what I believe to be a robust training stimulus, and they're at slightly below optimal protein intakes for muscle maintenance, let's call it they're at like 0.5, 0.6 grams per pound, let's say, we'll have a conversation about the potential benefits of more protein intake, which there are some, specifically in trained people, specifically in leaner people. But I'll be almost way more concerned with the training stimulus itself. So doing checks in terms of intensity, making sure somebody's close enough to failure, doing enough sets, that their technique looks good, that they're being consistent with that. The training stimulus is, again, if I had to sum it in a single sentence, the training stimulus is much more important. But again, if you're mega, mega low on protein, yeah, there's a lot of room for improvement there as well. Next, trying to fix my intensity, part of your group. Definitely could do more after prescribed sessions. Sometimes, not always, I do. Not because I don't trust you, but myself pushing hard enough. Fail in upper body, but struggle getting there in lower body. No, the bottom line is just do it. Any tricks? I mean, the first trick is that you're saying definitely could do more after prescribed sessions. And I think that the idea that you should be at the point where you could not do any more is a fallacy. So you should finish most of your workouts feeling good, you know, not like completely 100% fresh, especially off of a hard lower body day. But I think that the first thing I would do is think about your intensity within single sets, not how you feel at the end of a session. I don't want you thinking, oh, by the end of my session, I'm really gassed. That to me doesn't tell me anything. I want to know, well, it tells me something, but not nearly as important as if you look at each individual set, did you get close to failure? Right? The aggregate of doing that a bunch and insofar as it affects how you feel at the end of a session, I'm less concerned about. So if just because you could do more after the prescribed sessions doesn't tell me and shouldn't be necessarily alerting you that you didn't work hard enough in your sets. I would forget about that and I would think, how hard am I working in my sets? And I've been, obviously you're asking this question because I've been banging this drum in the group on social media for a bit of time now, which is making sure you're getting close to failure. And one of the more objective ways that you know you're doing that is that your concentric rep speed should slow down involuntarily, meaning despite your best effort to move the weight, it's slowing down because you're getting tired, you're getting close to failure. So you said you fail in upper body, but you struggle to get there in lower body. By the way, very generally speaking, that's pretty normal. When people say lower body, they tend to be referencing things like compound lifts, split squats, RDL squats, hack squats. I bet you that, you know, in contrast, going to failure with upper body, what they tend to be referencing is, you know, machines, cables, you know, free weight curls and stuff like that. And yes, if you compare it like that, it's easier, safer, more practical to go to failure on a bicep curl than it is on an RDL, for example. So I don't think that that's weird at all. I would say, what about your leg extensions? What about your ham curls? What about the abduction machine? You know, what about, you know, split squats that maybe have a little bit more stability, lunges where you're using the Smith machine? Here's the deal. The fact that you are even asking this question, I bet you are training hard enough and all you need to do is focus on progression. The pursuit of progression, I would say. So yeah, I'm not surprised you fail more frequently, more consistently with your upper body lifts. There tends to be more stability. Just machines and cables tend to be a little bit easier to push to failure versus things like RDLs and squats, maybe even hack squats. I don't think you need to go all the way to failure, specifically on those heavy compound lower body lifts. So I would find some solace in knowing you don't absolutely have to be failing on your RDLs and hack squats and split squats to be making gains. The trick, you said any tricks, here's what I want you to do. I want you to take some form videos in maybe week 3 or week 4 within your program, and I want you to check the speed of your reps. So I want you to watch your first 3 reps. Obviously, those first 2 or 3 reps are going to move nice and smooth, especially if we're talking about a set of 8 to 10. And then, you know, not fast forward, but you can watch a whole set. When you get to the end, watch the last one or two reps. Do those reps move significantly slower? If they do, I would say that you are doing a great job, and all I want you to focus on is trying to do a tiny bit more week to week. Just try, when I say try, I mean try, meaning it won't always happen, but try to do a little bit more week to week, and you're going to be golden. And forget about this idea of, well, if I could do more after the prescribed sessions, I should. That is a fallacy. You should be feeling pretty good after your workouts. Yes, you know, a smidge fatigued, definitely local fatigue, but overall not trashed. And so I would hope that there's some wisdom in there for you. Have you worked with clients using Adipex? Done much research on it? Need help with food, noise, but not obese per BMI, so don't qualify for GLP-1. I'm sitting at my computer. Adipex. What is it? It's Phentermine. Gotcha. Cool. I have had clients take Phentermine before, years ago, and more recently as part of a tapering off protocol from GLP-1s. I think that at the time when Phentermine was a very popular drug for treatment of, let's say, excess adiposity, it did a good job. And again, at the time, compared to what else was out there, it was a good, let's say, risk-reward ratio for people who needed it. I'd say that it is less good from a risk-reward ratio than some of these GLP-1 medications, specifically tirzepatide or Zepbound. And again, if you're not familiar with GLP-1 medications and their names, just go back to my most recent podcast from last week, what I believe to be a really good resource to learn about that stuff. I would be tempted is the word to use. I know when I would talk to my doctor for sure. I would be tempted to figure out a way to use a GLP-1 medication, specifically tirzepatide. If I was in a position where I wanted to lose weight and I felt that I needed some pharmacological help as of today, even if I didn't exactly qualify per BMI, so insurance wasn't really helping out, I would find a way to take FDA-regulated tirzepatide. As of recording of this podcast, February 11th, that's what I would do. I think that because there are just safer, more effective drugs out there, I would not, you know, again, if you go on Phentermine for a little while and it works and you find a way to upgrade yourself eventually to tirzepatide and some of these other drugs, CagriSema, retatrutide, that are coming out, I think that that's a fine kind of on-ramp. I don't see it as beneficial a drug from a risk to reward ratio. And so I would try and find a way to get my hands on some FDA regulated tirzepatide. I know people are going through some non-FDA regulated sources, and I just can't in good conscience recommend that. You know, if you and your doctor have a alternative route that you guys decide is good for you guys from a risk reward ratio, then that's on you. But that is the route I would go. Next question. In your program for about 6 months. Love it. Thank you. That's awesome. Want to escape dieting and focus on recomp build. What should I track or look for to see progress? Yeah, number one thing I would track is your strength on average on your lifts over time. The best proxy we have for muscle growth in the medium to long term is strength. In the short term, it's messy, but in the long term, if you're like, hey, I used to RDL 100 pounds for 10 reps, and now I RDL 185 pounds for 10 reps, there's just no world where your glutes and hamstrings haven't grown significantly. So I would focus on your strength on the lifts in the program. You know, one of the caveats is if you're not in a program designed for hypertrophy, meaning if you're in a really like a very specific powerlifting program, then you could be getting stronger without building that much muscle. But most kind of general resistance training programs, and obviously specifically hypertrophy programs, are going to be putting you in a situation where as long as you're getting stronger across the board over weeks and months and programs, you're doing awesome and you're building muscle. If you felt like you wanted to monitor your body weight, if you just felt comfortable with the scale and you wanted to do that, but if, you know, I can understand if getting out of the, you said escape dieting, if part of that is also getting off the scale, then I respect that a ton. But let's say you wanted to get on the scale, I would seek to either maintain your body weight. If you are someone in a slightly larger body with a little bit more body fat, I would seek to maintain your body weight. If you're somebody on the leaner side, I might seek to see a very, very, very small incremental weight gain, maybe a pound or less per month on average over many months to signify, you know, net muscle growth. But if you are somebody who's like, hey, I'm, you know, in a position where I probably on average care more about fat loss, I'd probably maintain your weight during that period. And obviously I'd focus on eating enough protein. Again, whether you're tracking or not, getting a large portion of protein three meals per day, some sort of hand-sized protein source. You could even just loosely count protein and aim for something like 0.7 grams per pound or 1 gram per pound of lean body mass if you have an idea about your body fat percentage. But all in all of that leads to the outcome of you getting stronger month after month, program after program. So that is the outcome that would tell me the most, right? You getting enough sleep, eating enough protein, not too many calories, not too few calories. All of it will come out in the final outcome to the right side of the equal sign of, am I getting stronger on my lifts over time? Next question. Been a bit poorly, but not enough to not train. I knocked a set off each exercise. So doing 3 sets for each, 6 or 7 exercises instead of 4. Holy crap. That's still a ton of sets. So you're doing 3 sets of 7 exercises and your program previously said, 4 sets of 7 exercises? Holy crap. All right, the second part of the question. I think I prefer 3 sets. Bit less time in the gym, feel less wiped out by the end. Would it be detrimental to keep it this way? I strength train for vanity reasons. I think what you were doing was somewhere between 24 and 28 working sets. To me, that's a pretty terrible program. That is a program chock full of junk volume. I actually think that if somebody can survive 28 working sets in a program, they're not working remotely close to failure. So you going down to like 18 to 21 working sets to me still screams, a situation where one could be more efficient with training a little harder with a little less to get at worst the same gains in less time or at best better gains. So I think you did a good job going down to 3 sets. 4 sets feels absolutely insane. Again, you didn't mention how many times you're training per week, so that does matter to some degree. If you're like, well, this is my only workout per week, then I might say, okay, YOLO a little bit, and it is what it is. But if this is three or four, God forbid, 5 sessions per week, yeah, that's a ton. So would it be detrimental? No, I think you'll get better progress this way. It will let you work harder. It'll get you better progress if you use the reduction in work to work harder in the stuff you're doing. Frankly, if you were asking me straight up, again, assuming you're doing this 3 or 4 times a week, I would reduce even more. I'd look to be, you know, in that 8 to 14 working sets per workout to ensure that you have enough energy to actually put forth a good effort into each set. Again, personally, but there are plenty of other program variables that could change that prescription. I'm speaking to somebody, I can't see your program or anything like that, but at face value, first glance, knee-jerk feelings, that's how I feel. Next question. Heard another coach say they can see on a form video how many reps they had left. Can you? How can I assess my own? I'm shaking in real life, but on video, it all looks the same to me. So I do this all the time with my clients. I do it all the time with people in the group who ask for it. I will say that it's just an opinion, right? Like, it's like I don't know for sure how many reps you had left. But what I can say is this happens to me often where I'll do a set and later, you know, I've been posting all my videos on my forum on my story for like a year now. And I will, as I'm putting up the forum video onto my stories, I'm watching it back. And as I'm watching it back, I'm remembering what that set was like. And I'm training incredibly hard right now in each set because I'm not doing a lot of training. So all of my sets are like a 0 or 1 RIR. But sometimes I'll watch a video back, and we talked about this maybe 10 minutes ago about this concentric rep speed slowing down. And I'll be like, well, it felt like failure at the time or felt like 1 RIR, but the video makes it look like I had more in the tank. And it's, that does not mean I discount my experience at all. And totally. I lived that set and my perception was that it was very, very close to failure. But sometimes it's good to have that objective look and say, well, the rep speed didn't really slow down at all. You're not like making some crazy faces. You're not, your eyes aren't bulging out of your head. Like, was that really failure? And so do I tell myself, no, that means I was 100%, I could have done another one or I could have done another two. No, but I do take that information on board. When I watch that form video back, sometimes I'm like, you know what? Even though it might have felt like failure, maybe you had another one in you based on the lack of a decrease in speed or a lack of enough decrease in rep speed. So I would assess it by taking a form video, checking your rep speed from the first rep to the last rep, you know, with an eye to the last few reps, having your rep speed slow down. I think that there is definitely a dichotomy between what it felt like in the moment and what the video says sometimes. And I don't think you just trust the video. I think you also want to trust how it felt to you in the moment. But again, how it felt in the moment sometimes can be affected by other things. If it's a really high rep set, maybe you just got fucking bored or the metabolites started to build up and you had this burning sensation, you know, which kind of points to maybe a downside of super high rep sets. But I like to watch my form videos back and I just take that information as data. I take the data of how I felt during the set and I think, okay, maybe I had another one in me, but I'm certainly not overly prioritizing one over the other. Next question. I'd like to lose a little fat. I like food. Could I do it by just upping cardio a bit each week or by upping strength training? Happy for it to be super slow. In theory, mathematically speaking, yes. Yeah, in theory, totally. You could keep your food the same and increase movement. I would say strength training is going to have such a marginal, if any, impact on your TDE. I would not count that as a dial that I would turn up in an attempt to create a meaningful deficit. It's just so ridiculously hard to create a deficit by doing more strength training. You just do not burn that many calories. Could you up cardio? Again, mathematically, you absolutely could. There's just the same thing. Eating less, moving more, accomplishes, in theory, the same thing. Now, without going into necessarily what happens when we do this to large populations in the research, you know, when people just up cardio and they don't have any changes to their nutrition, people don't really lose weight. They tend to just eat back those extra calories that they burned. So in like a free living scenario on a population level, it's just not really a great plan. But again, mathematically, if you kept your nutrition exactly the same and you increased cardio, that would create some form of a deficit. Practically speaking, I think that this only works for people that are, practically, not physiologically, but practically, somewhat physiologically, and I'll touch on that, but practically this probably only works for people that are sedentary. So going from sedentary to, let's say you're doing sub 5,000 steps a day, going from that to 10,000 steps per day, you know, let's say 10,000 steps per day burns roughly 500 calories per day, roughly, super roughly. And so if you were doing 5,000, burning roughly 250, let's say, you go to 10,000, you burn another 250 calories per day, and that's all you do, and you are in a 250 calorie deficit, you will lose some weight. I mean, that's, you know, mathematically speaking, with some of this old math, that would lead to about a half pound loss per week, at least for a while until you adapted to this new deficit and lost a bit of weight. And so you could do that, but we do see that there's an efficiency problem. So, you know, I said that going from 5,000 to 10,000 is an extra 250 calories. That's probably not actually true. It's probably, I'm going to make this up, but the more steps you do, let's say, the less calories you get per extra unit of steps. So going from zero to 5,000, let's call it, is 300 calories. I'm making this up. Please don't take this as gospel. Let's say zero to 5,000 is 275 calories. And from 5,000 to 10,000 is an extra, again, same 5,000 increase is 225 calories. And then from 10,000 to 15,000, same 5,000 calories is maybe 200 calories. And it gets, you become more efficient, which is a good thing for performance in many ways, but a bad thing for fat loss. We want to be inefficient. We want to waste calories. We don't want to be conserving them because we're so good at this movement now. So if somebody's pretty sedentary, I think that this is potentially practical. If I have a client who's like, hey, I'm at maintenance and I'm getting 4,000 steps. What if I got 8? What if I got 10? Yeah, I think that you'd lose a little weight for sure. I think in most cases, you said lose a little bit of fat. So I think it's possible. But if somebody was trying to lose a significant amount of weight, it just is not practical. And so it's something at the end of the day, without knowing much more about you, it ends in the sentence of you could try and see how it goes. Mathematically, it's possible. Practically, you know, realistically for you, an individual that I don't know anything about, it might it might work. Again, I don't even know what your expectations are. So it might, you wanted to lose 3 pounds, it might happen. If you want to lose 10 pounds, it might not happen. So it falls into this thing of you could try it, you know, but if you're going from like 8,000 to 10,000, I wouldn't expect any detectable weight loss. Again, even though mathematically that would be more calories burned, it would just take so long for that small increase in calories to manifest on the scale. What do we got? 30 minutes. We'll do a couple more. Next question. At what point do you start intra-run fueling? Runs greater than 90 minutes? It's a good question. It depends. It depends on the intensity of the run, not just the length. A very loose ballpark is I would consider it for runs longer than 60 minutes. I wouldn't consider it for runs less than 60 minutes. Realistically, though, like if you were trying to optimize performance, like I had a tiny gel during my 10K, which was, you know, ironically, it was not a 10K. It was like a 13 or 13 and a half K. So, you know, that run was supposed to be 50 minutes or so. And I had an intra workout gel there. But within training, I probably wouldn't fuss with those absolutely microscopic marginal benefits that can happen there. And so I think runs greater than 90 minutes is a good idea. It depends on the athlete, depends on the habitual diet, depends on the intensity of the run. But I will tell you that north of 60 minutes, I'd probably fuel something. Probably even if it was just putting on my vest and putting in some Gatorade or what's that Tailwind stuff, putting it into my kind of Camelback drink. So I'd say about longer than 60 minutes is when I would start to consider it, but it depends on the intensity. If I was going out for a 60-minute zone two run, I probably wouldn't. If I was going for 60 minutes of, you know, maybe harder intervals, you know, 75 minutes for harder intervals, I think if it's a long, slow run at the 90-minute mark, I would bring some fuel. If it's an interval workout up to 60 minutes, I probably bring some fuel. But zone two run for 60 minutes, probably not. Zone two run for 90 minutes, that's probably when I would start to bring some fuel. But I think even then you could get by with a low intensity hour and a half run and do just fine. I'd pay attention to cardiac drift, meaning like, does your heart rate actually start to creep up above what you believe to be zone two? Does your RPE start to creep up? You know, am I running in the heat? So there's a lot of variables here, but I don't think that that's a bad idea. 60 minutes or less, maybe don't fuel. North of 60 minutes, consider fueling. Next question. Joined up with a new coach to build muscle, but got an immediate calorie bump of 250, and I'm afraid that's too much. Does that sound reasonable? It seems... Listen, if you want to build muscle, and you've been... If you want to build muscle maximally, and you've been maintaining your weight for the last 3 months on 2,000 calories, I would be increasing somebody's calories by like 5%, which would be about 100 calories. But I think 250... is also going to maximize muscle growth, but maybe you gain a little bit extra fat on top of that. So there's a lot here. I don't want to be like rude. First of all, I don't even know how large you are. And that, by the way, that could be a small 10% increase, a 5 to 10% increase if you're on 2,500 calories or more, right? Maybe you're on 3,500. You know, right now I'm a larger active person, but my maintenance calories are close to 4,000. And so that would be about a 5% increase, right? It'd be like a 6% increase for me. So that would make sense. So it depends. I would want to see somebody in about a 5 to 10% surplus. And so this is, you know, 10% surplus. If you're at 2,500, this would meet that requirement. If you were eating like 1,750 and maintaining your weight, this might be a little bit larger, but I don't want to fearmonger. It sounds reasonable. Like it's not huge. It's really not huge. I promise it's not huge. Even if you're on 1750, I still don't think that that's a massive, massive jump. I think that that's still pretty reasonable. But if you absolutely knew what your maintenance calories were because you've been tracking there for the last several months maintaining your weight, I probably would take a smaller bump just to optimize what's called the P ratio, where I would gain a little bit less body fat. Even if I gained a little bit slower muscle, I'd gain less body fat along the way. But 250 sounds super reasonable. You might gain a little bit of body fat. And listen, ultimately, you might on the end of this have to do a little bit of a cut, but it seems reasonable. You're not going to get, you know, let's say super fat with 250 calories over maintenance. And I think, you know, 6 months from now, you'll have built some really, really nice muscle. So I would take a deep breath and know that that's not crazy. That sounds pretty reasonable. Could you potentially gain muscle with less fat, with a little bit smaller surplus if that's, you know, if you're only on like, if you were only on 1,800 calories before this? Maybe. But still not too crazy. Next question. We'll go to, how many more? That was a lot more. Crap. Let's keep it going. How are you really able to dig into a muscle for just one working set? I often feel like I need to get to the third set to really truly exhaust the muscle. And I take each set until I literally fail. Not just, I don't want to, my brain, my brain wants more, but my muscles say no, but somehow I can do it again. There's a lot in this question. You say, how are you really able to dig into a muscle for just one working set? I don't even know what that means. I think that there might be some, again, expectations of how much work you need to do to build muscle. You might be feeling like I need to, like you said, really, truly exhaust the muscle. I'm not sure you really need to, air quote, really, truly exhaust the muscle. What we need to do is stimulate the muscle for growth. And we need to do enough volume that we're progressing over time. And so I feel like somewhere between one and three working sets, depending on the amount of exercises you're doing and which exercises, works really great. Me personally, I'm doing an experiment with myself right now. This might be where this question comes from. I'm doing an experiment where I'm only doing one working set per exercise. For some rationales that I might go to a bit more in the future, I'm not going to go into it necessarily right now. So I think you can do three working sets. And let's be real, three working sets is a stock standard prescription that works really great. If you work hard, do enough sets, you know, for enough years, you'll be jacked. Like, I have no problem with that at all. What I will say is, if you're taking a set, like, you are really adamant that you're training to failure, if you're repeating rep numbers from set to set, it's not failure. Now, I'm not saying that can never happen, right? It's not like, oh, I got eight on the set and I got eight again. I'm not saying it could never be the case that those are both zero RIR, but almost never is that possible. So if you're like, well, I do three sets of 10 and they're all to failure, that's an oxymoron. It's just like straight up oxymoron. It's like telling me you run three marathons back to back as fast as possible and you got the same pace every time. It's like, well, then that first one, you'd have to believe you had more gas in the tank. And so if that is what you're saying, you're ending the sentence with, but somehow I can do it again. If it is matching reps, then I don't think it's actually failure, or at least often, it's probably not often failure. Sometimes if you don't warm up appropriately, that first set, you can get eight and it feels like failure. And then the second set, you get eight again. And it's in all likelihood because you weren't appropriately warmed up for that first set. So while you're a little bit more tired for the second set, you're also a little bit more warmed up. And the net of those two things has you repeating that performance. But shit, if you do it for a third time, you get eight again. Now I'm questioning if they were failure. By the way, not everything needs to be to failure. And if I was doing three sets, you know, it'd be a rare case that I would prescribe three sets to failure of something. At least, you know, maybe the last set before, the last week before a deload, training just happens to be this hard. So hopefully there was some helpful stuff in there. You know, it also depends. So if I am working my pecs, so I do about four working sets per muscle group per week. And so I'm doing one work, I'm doing four to six sets per muscle group per week right now. And so I'm doing four to six exercises. So I might do one working set of incline dumbbell press, but I'm also doing one set of cable flies. So my pecs are actually getting two working sets. So you are feeling like, oh, to get my muscle truly exhausted, I need three sets. It's like, well, I'm doing two sets, just two different exercises, you know? And so I think at the end of the day, there's some stuff baked in here of you really, really, you think you need to truly exhaust the muscle to grow. I think people underestimate the power of frequency, overestimate the power of wrecking their muscle within a single workout. Your goal should not be to wreck your muscle within a single workout. Your goal should be to do a lot of productive work across the week. And I've found that doing a little less per session, a little bit more across the week, has made me feel like the workouts are easier, has made me less sore. And I know that for somebody in your position, that might start to feel odd, where you're like, oh, these workouts aren't as hard. I'm not as sore. I'm not as obliterated. It's like, yeah, but that's probably an upside of splitting things up a little bit more. And again, there's a bit more of a philosophical discussion on here, but we're not going to do that today. Next question. Can calories stay the same on a deload week? I would. If you're getting the same amount of steps and activity, that's going to be the biggest impact on your TDE, not, you know, whether you did one working set or three. So I would keep them the same. Frankly, the irony is if your workout is shorter, you might even get more steps on deload week because you're in the gym less. All in all, I would just keep it the same. Don't think your calories change much on deload week. HRT, MHT experts you recommend, in perimenopause and finding non-grifty experts whose guidance is trustworthy feels challenging. It is challenging. I'm going to say this, I don't want to be triggering. I don't want people to think I'm like mansplaining. I do not want it to come out that way. All I'm saying is that the women's health sector of our fitness space, talking about menopause, perimenopause, menstrual cycle, cycle syncing, all this stuff, is rife with grifters who are taking advantage of this population because this population, being women and specifically perimenopausal women, postmenopausal women, feel slighted in some way because they are underrepresented in the literature. And then you have people in the industry who are saying, you know, I'll be your voice. I actually know what you need. Don't listen to these men who are only referencing studies about men. And by the way, this isn't necessarily a men versus women thing. This is just there's a large amount of money to be made doing the same thing that people do in the fitness space, selling misinformation, selling unnecessary supplements, selling hacks to a system that doesn't need hacking, in this women's health perimenopause space. So this isn't me on a pedestal at all. And there are some amazing creators, people doing a great job. I don't even think this is the worst space, but it's just like every other space within our bubble where there are people selling misinformation, supplements you don't need, selling you a story that isn't true, that, you know, are just maybe appealing to a population that feels underrepresented in the literature, which they are underrepresented in the literature, totally. And I've just seen this a lot. Yeah, I listen, the people who are experts in HRT, MHT, I am not an expert in it. And I wish I had better recommendations for you. I don't. I love Jen Gunter. I think Jen is a good source of evidence-based information. No bullshit, selling you the truth, anti-grifter. I'd be curious if she had any people she would recommend. I tend to recommend people talk to their PCP about it. But I also know that not all PCPs are. I don't want to shit on. I'm not shitting on doctors, but I just know that the quality of doctor, specifically in this category, is probably wide ranging. Next question: ever thought of starting a Substack? I think your content would do great there, and you could recycle, upcycle, or reuse a lot of what you recreate. A lot of what you already create. So Substack is an interesting platform. From what I follow a few people on Substack, it's basically just like long form written content. I really love long form written content. I like it. I do an email newsletter every week that I might consider turning into a Substack. I would want it to be profitable. I don't mean that I'm just like some money hungry, that's all that matters. It just would have to be a fruitful endeavor. That's all. I'm not saying it needs to be this crazy big income, but it would need to be a fruitful endeavor. I'm certainly spread thin right now. I have not ever thought of it, but maybe I'll put something on social media. Maybe I'll give it some thought. I do think that, again, not to get political, I just think there's probably some weird stuff that's going to happen to our, there's weird stuff already happening, but weird stuff that's going to be happening to the social media landscape between what Zuckerberg has done, between Elon with Twitter, people just overall, we won't go there, but just like a small degradation to the integrity of these companies, in my opinion. And so having a place that's maybe a bit more unbiased where, content creation is just a little bit less polarizing and people go to actually get good high quality information. That might be something interesting. I'm curious if people use Substack for other than long form written content. That is me maybe not knowing enough about Substack. But I'm going to make a quick note. I'm sitting at my computer right now. I'm going to make a note just to take what is Substack? That'll be my note. What is Substack? Because everything you change about your business and your career is for one of two goals. It's to make more money or to improve quality of life. And so if I was to do a Substack, I have to ask myself, is this going to be something that I would make more money doing? Maybe. Is this something that I would enjoy? The answer is definitely yes. So even if it's not an amazing business, it's so scalable and all this crap, I do think I would enjoy it. And so
that is an important thing to me. So I'm going to take a look into it. What's your take on the suggestion that you take your weight and multiply it by X to determine your deficit or maintenance calories? When I do this, the numbers I get are very low and wouldn't be sustainable. I've tracked for years. Is this method reliable and I'm just an outlier? So what she's mentioning is like, I love Jordan Syatt. He's one of my close friends in the industry. He's been a mentor of mine for a long time. Jordan will commonly say, hey, take your body weight, multiply it by 12. That's your deficit. You know, multiply it by 15. That's your maintenance. Multiply by 18 for a surplus. By the way, that's not a direct quote. It's something like that. This is, of course, the least scientific way to get your maintenance calories. I'm not shitting on Jordan. The point is, it's no frills, it's no fuss, and you can get that number right now and you can start. And that is the benefit of doing something like this. You know, if I wanted to calculate my maintenance, I would take, let's just say, my body weight and times 15. I'm 190 pounds. That's a little less than 3,000 calories. Right? So that would be wildly off for me. So you're not an outlier if you're finding out that these sorts of things, by the way, I can't even be sure if that's the multiplier. So maybe it wouldn't be wildly off if somebody was like, you know, body weight, let's type this in Google, body weight times 12 for calorie deficit. Is that what people are saying? Yeah, that is what people are saying. 12, right. And that's an assumption that people are sedentary. That's what it says, that this is a formula often used in clinical weight loss, but the assumption is that people are sedentary. So you might have a activity multiplier in some ways here. So I don't think you're wrong. I think this method is, you say, is this method reliable? The truth is, I don't give a shit. Sorry, my language. I don't give a shit if the method is reliable. I care if the method gets you to just freaking start. Even if it's totally off, if I thought my maintenance calories was 3,000, I would be losing a significant amount of weight. And guess what? I would know that within the first week or two. I would know that it's a deficit. And guess what I would do? I would increase my calorie targets. And I would ultimately find out where I needed to go with some guess and check. So I think when it comes to any calorie calculator, it's just a guess. Even if I use the most scientific calculator that tries to account for all my activity, it's still going to be off. You still need to get started, track some data, and go from there. So yes, I don't think it's weird if you feel like you're an outlier or that your numbers are really off when you do this. I bet that they are off, but it doesn't really matter. What matters is that you get started, you track the data, you track how you feel, and you make the necessary adjustments. I get calories in, calories out, and the only way to lose fat is a deficit. Explain to me, coaches, that post clients that are eating more and losing weight. They were hardly eating anything before and they looked flabby. Now they're eating more and body comp totally changed. I'll tell you this. It is just a real simple thing. This did not happen. You know that who's that guy? Oh my God, I'm dating myself as a young person. It's like it never happened. That never happened. It's a myth. This never happened. There is only two ways that somebody could eat more and lose weight. And the scenario number one is if they were eating in a large deficit and then ate more than that, but were still in a deficit and continued to lose weight. And that scenario would not describe the scenario you're talking about, where somebody looks overweight, claims to be eating low calories, and then is eating more and now finally starts losing weight. That would not account for that scenario. The second scenario is that somebody thinks that they are or is attempting to eat low calories, like 1,200. You know, it's always a picture of an overweight person with 1,200 calories on the left. And then on the right, they're like, you know, have less fat, more muscle. And it's like, I'm eating, work my way up to 2,000 calories to lose weight and fix my metabolism. It's all horseshit. Physiologically speaking, this did not happen. This cannot happen. That person was never eating the amount of calories that they said they were eating on the left. And they might not be eating the amount of calories that they're saying on the right. They might be eating it for a few days. People always do this. I don't want to go on a huge rant. If you search Eric Trexler, reverse dieting, you will find an article on Macro Factor that goes through a lot of these scenarios. One of those scenarios, by the way, is people blow right past their maintenance calories. So you might see somebody who looks like they look leaner and more muscular and like, I worked my calories all the way up to 2,500. It's like, but actually 2,200 was their maintenance and they've been eating 2,500 for a few weeks, a week, 2 days, 1 day, and they claim this is how much I'm eating, and they're phrasing it in a continuous, in the continuous sense, the present tense, that this is what I'm currently eating. when in reality, they've been eating that for like 1 or 2 days. But they're taking a Post-it and they're putting that on their chest that says 2,500 calories. What we don't know is if they kept eating that much, would they actually be in a surplus? And so what I will say, just to put a bow on this, is that if somebody says that this is what happened, and usually in this is some fixing of metabolism or some reverse dieting or some breaking of a plateau, none of that happened. None of that happened. Nobody has ever lost more weight by eating more calories unless it improved their adherence such that they were actually finally able to sustain a deficit. Let's get to the hour. We got 10 minutes. Are you just trying to maintain muscle in a deficit? Training slash set number, relax a bit versus a build phase. You mean, is one just trying to maintain muscle in a deficit? I think you can take this in a multitude of different ways. Me personally, a very general philosophical approach would be to try and train as little as possible and maintain all of the muscle. Right? And those two things are counter to each other, right? I'm trying to maintain all my muscle, but I'm also trying to do it with as little training as possible. So frankly, I'd sooner reduce somebody's volume in a cut before increasing it just to make room for the stress of the deficit. The truth is, if your training is at an adequate volume, that you're doing an appropriate amount of volume, if you are in a relatively normal size deficit, you don't need to change anything. Like, your training should not change much, if at all, going into a cut. The only people who should change their training going into a cut is people that were training on super, super mega high volumes, like really pushing the boundaries of what they can recover from. And now they go into a deficit and, you know, okay, because they were at the real upper echelon of training volume, maybe it needs to come down a little bit. Or people who go into an aggressive diet. So aggressive dieting is kind of in vogue right now with Martin McDonald's calculator coming out, with Lyle McDonald kind of getting back into his protein sparing modified fast kick. There's a lot of cool research on aggressive dieting. It's going to be something I talk about a bit more. It's something I've done with clients for maybe the last year, a couple of times, but will be doing more when applicable. If somebody's in an aggressive diet, that's when I would really look at bringing training volume down a little bit. Again, not to zero. Of course, you're in an aggressive diet. You're in a larger deficit, presumably. You're at more risk for muscle loss. So maybe don't reduce training volume too much, but you also don't want to be doing so much high intensity work that you're just trashed all the time. So if you're doing mega high volumes, maybe bring it down a little bit. If you're doing a mega aggressive cut, maybe bring it down a little bit. But 90 to 95% of cases should be you doing enough volume that doesn't need to change. Training doesn't need to change very much going into a cut. Next question is breakfast options during a steep cut. Protein and plants. That's it. That's it. Egg whites, berries, you know, veggies, a lot of onions, peppers, omelets, you know, with a lot of, you know, mushrooms, onions, peppers, tomatoes, stuff that's not going to take up a lot of calories, going to taste nice. That's going to fill you up. A lot of berries, raspberries, blueberries. You know, getting out of this idea of having to, you know, incorporating some non-breakfast foods during this time, I think can be a decent idea. Don't close the door off to, like, you know, chicken, lean meats, you know, vegetables. A lot of people don't love vegetables first thing in the morning, but shit, man, if you're in a steep cut, it can help. I would probably just start to gently move away from liquid calories, you know, if you haven't already. So if you were having shakes, try and find some whole foods. Yeah, I like egg whites. I know it sounds, I mean, if I'm in a steep cut, egg whites, chicken, low-fat cheese, a lot of veggies can be a really, really nice breakfast option. Oatmeal is okay. You know, you can do protein oatmeal. You can do oatmeal and egg whites. Some people even put egg whites in the oatmeal. Don't ask me about it. They do it. I don't know what's up with them, but they do it. Non-fat Greek yogurt with a lot of berries, not, you know, lower-fat cottage cheese can work really well. So a lot of those things that kind of optimize satiety per calorie. Next question. Do you have any specific thoughts on THC, specifically microdosing, occasionally for things like sleep and social anxiety? Any negative health impacts? Yeah, it's interesting. I, in the past maybe 5 years, have, I'll just admit, occasionally taken what I would consider a microdose of THC at night for, you know, I would try and wrap it up in something, but let's just call it like... if I take a tiny, tiny dose of THC, what's funny is I have gummies in the fridge or in the pantry right now. I cut them into like 1/8 of the size. I'm a lightweight. This shit affects me intensely. And so what happens on the night that I will do this is I will find that that is a night where that my mind races at night. And I think that this is, listen, I'm sure this is everybody, but, and I'm not trying to put entrepreneurs on a pedestal, but it's really hard for me to turn my brain off. There's always something I could be doing, right? I'm sure this goes for other jobs too, but there's always a thing I could be doing because there's no playbook for me. I want to make more money. I work harder. I want more followers. I post more. You know, I could always be doing more. And so my brain is always going. And so I sleep really well these days. I'm very happy with my sleep hygiene. But if I had an issue, it's turning my brain off at night. It's kind of packaging away my responsibilities for tomorrow. And I will say on the nights that I microdose THC, that takes care of that for me. Like I just fall asleep no matter what. Now, I would say I've been doing it less and almost not at all just because I don't ever want that to happen and then something would happen with my daughter. I'm not even high. Like I know it's just like, okay, I don't need to defend it to you guys in the podcast, but like, it just doesn't feel right. The idea that I'd wake up, something would happen. I would need to be my best. Jordan Sy cracks me up. He was saying, he maybe used to do this, but like doesn't do this anymore because he wants to make sure if somebody like broke into his house, he'd be ready to go. I don't want to laugh at that as if doesn't happen. It totally happens. But yes, you know, he was, I think in the moment making light of it that he's like in a ready mode, you know? So specifically to your question, I understand very much how this can be helpful. So THC improves what's called sleep latency, meaning the time it takes to fall asleep. And that is very specifically what I was using it for, which was maybe once a week, I would, you know, on the weekend, maybe a microdose where honestly with me, I don't know how people do things high, like, or on THC, I fall asleep immediately. Like a minute hits me. I'm like, all right, good night. And so that's a nice thing for me to once in a while, just like have my brain shut off for me. I don't think doing what I was doing had real negative health impacts. I think you said microdosing it occasionally. If that's occasionally like every day, maybe there's probably a meaningful benefit over the long term. If this is a once a week thing, I don't know. Just like, you know, something like alcohol. If you're like, hey, I have one or two drinks a week, I don't think it would ever amount to a measurable impact. What I will say is THC does decrease sleep quality, though. It might improve sleep latency, but it decreases sleep quality. We see, you know, I don't know if it's specifically decrease in REM sleep or decrease in deep sleep, but it decreases the just quality of your sleep architecture. And so it's something I'm doing a whole lot less, you know, once a month, maybe. It's actually been a long time. And so I don't think the occasional microdose THC is going to have a meaningful health impact. I think that there are pros and cons to, you know, to consider here, especially for things like sleep, social anxiety, maybe nighttime anxiety, that I would consider on an individual basis. But speaking on a podcast here, I can't recommend that you do this very often. Although, you know, there are a lot of applications where THC has been proven to be a net benefit in people's life. I'm not saying, you know, be a pothead or anything like that, but there are a lot of anecdotes and even medicinal purposes, of course, where this can be a net benefit. So I don't want to rule that out. Yeah, hopefully that was a nice nuanced take on it. Don't recommend people do drugs, but I also understand that these things have applications. And, you know, if you ask me specifically negative impacts on health, if you're microdosing occasionally, I doubt it has a meaningful impact on health. Cool. Last question. Could you get so many members we lose the personal touch? Sorry. Could you get so many members we lose the personal touch we all love? The answer is absolutely not. I don't know if the group will ever have double the members it has now. We're at like 900 members. You know, I'd love to have it double and triple and quadruple. Right now, I do several things. I do the podcast. I have my one-on-one coaching business. I have the group. I plan on having another group at some point. You know, I do social media, whatever. If the group ever got to a point where I was losing my ability to give my 100%, which I feel I give to the group, I would do less of something else. I absolutely love my group. I absolutely love what we do there. I love that we provide an unbelievable amount of value for a relatively cheap cost, and that it is a really nice entry point. Just it's, you know, costs $34 a month, not hundreds of dollars like one-on-one coaching. And so I will never, ever, ever let the personal touch go. And I will never, ever, ever, you know, let that, the amount of members and the amount of work it would take, impact my quality there. So you can take that one to the bank, as the kids would say. All right. Thanks for listening, guys. I'll see you in the next episode.
Thanks for tuning in to this episode of Where Optimal Meets Practical. If you liked the episode, it would mean the world to me if you posted a screenshot to your social media or left a 5-star review on iTunes. That stuff really helps. If you ever want to get in touch with me, just shoot me a DM on Instagram @JordanLipsFitness. I'm always around to chat. Thanks, guys. Have a good one.